Good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you. This is an opportunity that I've been looking forward to, but the topic is actually a challenging one. And on the overhead tonight, you'll see that the topic is, why are our youth leaving the church? Now, when I was first assigned this topic, I was thinking about what biblical story could we use as to learn some lessons about and make application to our situation today. And I thought about David and Bathsheba and their second child, Solomon. I thought about Eli and his two sons. I even thought about Lot and his two daughters. And each one would have made a tremendous lesson. And then I realized that I was sort of skirting the question. That as much as I would enjoy just spending some time looking at these Old Testament stories with you, I think it's important that we face the facts. That we spend just a few minutes tonight together as parents, as young people, as Christians, as grandparents, thinking about why it is our youth are leaving the church. Now that's sort of a loaded question. It sort of assumes that they're leaving. And so I want to break it down just a little bit. In the United States, according to the last U.S. Census, there are approximately 1.5 million members of the Lord's Church in the United States. And about, according to the general population ratio, about 2.4%, I'm sorry, I should have a period there, of our young people, of our members, are under the age of 18 years. So, doing the math, that would be about 21,300 young people in the Lord's church today. And so there's three questions that I want to look at tonight. First of all, how many are leaving the church? Secondly, why are they leaving? And thirdly, what can we do about it? You know, it's hard to quantify how many are leaving. Anecdotally, perhaps you or and certainly I have stories that we could share of young people who, like the parable of the soils, has come to know God, and for perhaps the worldly cares of the world choking out their faith, or having a shallow faith, being unable to have the roots necessary to sustain that faith at such a young age. Many, though, if they do fall away or fail to be faithful in their attendance and in their service to the Lord, come back. But just how many are leaving, many experts have attempted to quantify. There's a book written by David Kinnaman entitled, You Lost Me. And it's not specifically about the Lord's church. It speaks more broadly about evangelical churches. But 18 to 25-year-olds, he found that 38% have acknowledged in surveys that they have serious doubts about their faith. Over half of them are less active in the church than they were at age 15. And 59% drop out of church, at least for a year or more. Another book written by the Fuller Youth Institute, based on their research, Sticky Faith, concluded that 40 to 50% of the kids who were connected to a youth group, when they graduate high school, fail to stick with their faith, hence the name of their book, in college. Only 20% of college students who leave the church plan to do so after high school, plan to do so during high school to leave after. The remaining 80% intended to stick with their faith, but didn't. And somewhere between 30 and 60%, according to the Fuller Youth Institute, of youth group graduates abandon their faith and the church, but then they return to it in their late 20s. So, what about the churches of Christ? One study that's somewhat dated now estimates that 55% of our young people, more than half, leave the church. A more recent study in 2008 found that it was more like 40%. You know, I can't give you a more exact figure than that. I do know this, that even one soul, is too many. And so I want to challenge us tonight to try to understand some of the reasons, to try to put our, you know, instead of just saying, well, that's a problem, and sort of giving up and becoming a little hopeless about it and despondent, I want to challenge us to unpack some of the reasons why that might be the case. I want us to try to put ourselves in the shoes of the young people to my right. And maybe I missed the mark. Each individual is different, and they're dealing with some issues that really are much more complicated than we can try to express in one night. And I want to say before we get into this any further that I'm proud of our young people. I think we have some exceptional young people. I had the privilege and the opportunity to work with Jared to teach the class for a quarter. And I'm mindful of what a wonderful job our parents are doing in this congregation to raise their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And I realize that our children are probably the exceptional category. But statistically, there are still risks. Even in this congregation, as blessed as we are, and even being in proximity to further resources at the university, I realize that it's easy for someone to slip through the cracks. I realize that people deal with situations that could weaken their faith. We want to do everything we can to help understand why they might be at risk. So the second question is why? And I want to suggest three reasons, and the first one is fairly straightforward. And the idea is that I want to suggest that they leave for cultural reasons. According to a Lifeway research study, 52% of the young people that left evangelical churches did so for cultural reasons. They indicated some sort of political or ethical belief that was different from the church's stated views, and that's the reason why they no longer were interested in church. They didn't believe what the church taught, or they didn't believe what they perceived the church to be teaching, and so they decided to go a different path. Now, this reminded me of the story of David and Solomon. Because in that story, you have a situation in which Solomon is described in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 3, as loving the Lord, walking in the statutes of David, his father, and only he sacrificed and burned incense in the high places as he ought. And so there's this wonderful legacy that Solomon has the opportunity to uphold, to this faith, this heart of David being passed on to his son. And yet, culture can have a bad influence on our young people. No matter who their parents are, no matter how blessed and privileged they are to be in the house of the Lord, look at what 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4 says about Solomon after some time. For it came to pass when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart. And as you know, he had hundreds of wives. And these were influencing, and their culture was from various idolatrous Gentile nations. And it says they turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not perfect with the Lord, his God, as was the heart of David, his father. In other words, the difference between Solomon and David was a matter of the heart. And yet, the reason why there was a difference in their heart was because of the cultural influences, I believe, in large part of Solomon's wives. And I think the same can be said of our young people today. That the difference is not between the difference in their heart now at a tender age of 15 or 13. I'm looking at several young faces. And where they'll be when they graduate high school during those key formative years of 18 and 21 and 24 years of age. That difference of heart is largely going to be determined by cultural influences of the day. So let me unpack this issue as it relates to our young people today. And that is, according to this research, 18% of the young people said that they disagreed with the church's stance on political or social issues. If you have been watching the news during this election year, you realize that the millennials, the younger portion of the millennials, have been staunchly supportive of certain candidates. In particular, Bernie was very popular. And to understand their political position is quite complicated. And we're not going to try to do that tonight, but I just want to make an observation. And that is, this study shows the separation of voting preferences between young people and older people. And how you can see for years, when in 72 when Nixon became president, or 76 when Carter, or even 1980 when Reagan, you can see the young people and the old people pretty much are in tow with one another, at least among those that are voting for a Democratic candidate and who they preferred. But what you'll see in the last two or three elections is a widening gap between the generations and in their political preferences. 17% also reported they're only going to church to please others. 16% they no longer wanted to identify with any church, organized religion. So culturally, there's a lot of pressure to abandon the organized religions of the day and to check the box when asked, what's your religious affiliation? None. And so 36%, this is up 11% since 2007, 36% of 18 to 24-year-olds are now claiming, self-describing themselves as religious nuns, over one out of three. There's a second reason, though, I think that the youth may be leaving the church, and that is relational. And this one may be more of an indictment against us than it is them. 58% reported this is the primary reason why they were leaving their religious affiliation. The story that I had in mind that would illustrate how relations can influence for good or for bad, is the story of Eli and his two sons. You remember in 1 Samuel chapter 2 how the sons of Eli were described. It says, quote, "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men." You know, there's a lot of things I'd want on my tombstone. But to be said of me, he was worthless, would not be one of them. They did not know the Lord. Now get this, Eli was not said to be an evil man. In fact, he was the high priest. He was in an intimate relationship with God, with Jehovah. And yet, his relationship with his sons was lacking. He was clearly missing the opportunity to be the father that he should be. And as a result, they did not come to know God. Now, here's what the studies are saying about young people leaving the church for relational reasons. More than a quarter of them say that church members seem judgmental or hypocritical. Another 20% say they just didn't feel connected to the people at their church. 15% said church members were unfriendly and unwelcoming. Some just said they just wanted to take a break from this church thing. I don't know about you, but I hope that we are all committed to not help keeping people from the cross. That we understand that it would be worse for us, according to Jesus, to be a stumbling block and to cause one of his young ones to lose their faith. And if by carelessly or thoughtlessly failing to make them feel welcome, we were to cause them to disconnect from this spiritual nourishment that they receive as part of the fellowship, how horrible we would feel. Now, the third reason is perhaps the most significant. And this reason I would describe as situational. Just life changes is the reason why so many young people, 97%, claim this was part of the reason, if not the primary reason, why they left the church. Now, this story that I had in mind to illustrate this is Genesis chapter 19, the story of Lot. And there's so much that we could say about Lot's story and how he created a situation that led to this horrific situation where his own daughters got him drunk and caused him to commit incest. And they try to rationalize it here in Genesis chapter 19, verses 31 and 34, saying there's not a man on earth, which is not true. It was a false crisis. But there's not a man on earth to come in to us after the manner of all the earth, so we will do this horrible thing. And they not only did it once, they did it twice. But the point to be made about this situation is they didn't wake up one day and decide to do this. I firmly believe that Lot created a situation gradually over time that led to the capacity for them to commit this kind of heinous sin. It started way back when Abraham said, choose. And he chose and pitched his tent towards Lot. It started when he was taken prisoner and God he was trying to chastise him and give him a lesson. And yet he refused to learn that lesson and moved right back to Sodom. It started when Lot was trying to raise his family in a horrific situation of sin and idolatry and the most debauchery that you could think of. And when the angels come to visit, he is trying to solve the problem of them being accosted by offering up his own daughters. You see, I believe that this horrific sin that his daughters commit, he was responsible for by the way he situated his children for literally all of their lives. And I wonder to what extent we're guilty of being a David or an Eli or a Lot. Whether we're aware of the impact of the kind of culture in which we live, the kinds of relationships that we're encouraging our young people to build, the kind of situations that we allow themselves to be placed in. Here's what 23% of young people said was the reason why they left the church regarding situations in their life. Work, they said, made it impossible or difficult to attend. 23% said that. 25% said move to college. Now, obviously, as the vice president of enrollment management, this made my ears perk up a little bit. And I was trying to understand, what is it about college that would cause them to abandon their faith? You don't have to think about it that long. But I want to suggest three things that we can do that will make a difference, I hope, in whether or not our young people leave the church. The first thing I think we need to do is we need to be more intentional in the preparation of our children. One of the challenges of Proverbs chapter 11, verse 14, is to understand the wisdom of surrounding our young people with a spiritual community, with a group of mentors that they can trust in their wisdom and in their relationship with God to lead them on the straight and narrow path. Proverbs 11, 14 says, where there is no guidance, a people fail. But in an abundance of counselors, there's safety. Creating a safety net is part of our responsibility. And doing that intentionally is, I believe, a wise way to prepare our young people. The question is not, do your young people respect you as parents? The question is not, do you rule your house well? The question is, who is steering your child's boat when you're not there? How are we preparing our child for that transition in life when they are no longer under your roof? It is an opportunity for either blessing and spiritual growth or disaster and spiritual death. Now, I recently had the opportunity with the support of the eldership here to visit South Korea. And I was moved by the 25 or so congregations whose ministers and members I had a chance to interact with. And I'm mindful of how fast that society has grown. And one of the things that I was most perhaps amazed by was the educational system in South Korea. South Korea has one of the top 10, in fact, it's the number 2 educational system in the world right now. They emphasize this to such an extent that the young people go to school, public school, all day long, and then 90 to 95% of the families mortgage everything they have in order to afford to send those young people to school for a second time every day. They are in school till 10, 11 o'clock at night, guys. We just finished our first week of school. I'm sure you're exhausted. Can you imagine, as soon as you get home around 3:30, being told, okay, let's get back in the car, you've had your cookie and milk, and let's go to school again till 10. That's how you raise those standardized test scores. That's how you get Samsung and LG and the ability to build every cell phone and every TV in our houses right now, and our refrigerators and dishwashers too. But here's the second point. South Korea is also on the top 10 list for atheist nations. You see, they have stressed preparing their children, but they've done it in an unbalanced way. They've been feeding them academically, they've been stretching them intellectually, but spiritually it's a desert there. And we as Christians must prepare our young people holistically. Romans 12:2 says it this way: do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Will your son be a he or a Z at college? University of Tennessee a couple of years ago posted a guide on their Office of Diversity posted a guide trying to instruct faculty and staff and even students on the proper politically correct way to address young people in a gender-neutral way, because you don't want to assume Johnny wants to be referred to as a he. He may prefer his gender identity to be a she. Now, their president, less than a month later, took that off the internet, said he's not saying that we can't have those kind of discussions on campus, but we shouldn't be advertising it on the internet. Because it created quite an uproar here in Tennessee. After all, it is Tennessee. But don't worry, other universities do maintain these policies. Harvard just enacted theirs. Ohio, one of the largest universities in the country, has one. This kind of shaping of your beliefs will affect the way people, our young people think. What about Sonoma State University? Can your daughter wear a cross to college? You see, the choice they make for where they spend the first 4 transitional years out of the home is going to make a difference in what they think, how they think, because they're going to control what they do. They're going to control what they wear. This young freshman girl was told to take that necklace off on her first day of school. When she asked why, they said because it might offend one of the other students. How about your son's professor? Will he be allowed to trash his faith? Florida Atlantic University's professor has an exercise that has been challenged by some Christian students, but unsuccessfully. He continues to do it each semester. He says, take a piece of paper out, write the name Jesus, set it down on the floor beside your desk, stand up, and his instruction to the entire class is to stomp on it. What would you do as a Christian? How will that affect your faith? Can your child be flunked for refusing to deny Christ was real, like a student who challenged a professor who was constantly talking about Christ just being a myth and a legend, did at Polk State College? Can they be denied admission for mentioning their faith, like 2 applicants did to the radiation therapy program for a community college in Baltimore County? Now, keep in mind, these applicants met all the qualifications, but the director has gone on record in writing stating the reason why they were denied admission wasn't because they weren't qualified. It's because when they were asked one simple question, what's the most important thing in your life, they had the audacity to say, my God, and the other one said, my faith. What answer would you give? I mention this because each year, tens of thousands, over 20,000 young people in the churches of Christ have to make this transition. come to this crossroad and have to choose a college. And the question is that college going to help them remain faithful to God, or is it going to discourage them and cause them to increase risk of leaving the church? We have approximately 21,318-year-olds graduating, according to the latest census data. 74% will actually graduate from high school, so that gives you 15,762 with a diploma. Of those, 67% will go on to college. That's a little over 10,000. Now, you can count this a little differently by looking at how many take the ACT and the SAT, which is the test you have to take in order to get into college here in the United States. And 30,000 young people identify as members of the Church of Christ when they take the ACT. That's the box they check. Of those, 67%, according to the ACT company, will enroll in college. And 12.1% of those will attend a four-year private school. Not necessarily one affiliated with the Church of Christ, but a private four-year school as opposed to a public school. It's 2,400 kids. Bottom line, 2,200-plus young people. Out of all those young people in the church that graduate from high school every year, only 2,200 have the blessing, have the privilege of attending a Christian university. Somewhere between 5 and 17,000 choose to attend a secular college every year. For me, I believe with all my heart that's a missed opportunity. I believe that we're contributing, according to Flavel Yakeley's study from a few years ago. Here's the second point, though. We have to not only deliberately prepare our young people better by helping them make choices that will maximize their ability to face what the world has to throw at them, but we personally need to do a better job of deliberately leading our families. Right now, even before they leave home, you know Joshua and his statement in just Joshua chapter 24, verse 15. Such a powerful statement. And I'm speaking here directly to fathers and the leaders of their homes. He said, if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your fathers served in the region beyond the Ridge River or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That kind of deliberate, premeditated decision to lead, to be a male spiritual leader, is sorely needed if we're going to make a dent in the statistical fact of young people leaving the church today. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4 says it's not optional, it's a command. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up. Not mothers. Fathers have a responsibility. Two, to raise the children and to spiritually give them the discipline and instruction that they need in the Lord. The word for the first word for nurture is the same word that God uses to describe what He does to His children in Hebrews chapter 12. It's the same word that Paul used to tell Timothy the importance of giving instruction in 2 Timothy 3:16 through God's word. The other word, admonition, means literally putting in mind. In other words, imprinting on the minds of our young people the ways of the Lord. One of the first commands to teach our children was given to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18, verse 19. It says, "For I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him." It's a powerful statement, but it's the linchpin, it's the keystone to the promise to Abraham to bless many, many generations, including us as his spiritual offspring, spiritual Israel. It is that fundamental that we take seriously our responsibility, men, to prepare, to not just prepare our young people in general, but to provide the kind of spiritual leadership that they need. Here's what Woodrow Wilson wrote when he was president of Princeton University to parents that were complaining about the students of that university not coming out the way they expected them to. He says, "I get many letters from you parents about your children. You want to know why we people up here in Princeton can't make more out of them and do more for them? Let me tell you the reason we can't. It may shock you a little. I'm not trying to be rude. The reason is that they are your sons, reared in your homes, blood of your blood, bone of your bones. They have absorbed the ideals of your homes. You have formed and fashioned them. They are your sons. In those malleable, moldable years of their lives, you have forever left your imprint on them. I love that vision, that image of imprinting. One of the challenges as parents is to realize how little time we have with our young people. Doc B mentioned that Jennifer and I are grandparents. My oldest, Shelby, is married to a college minister down in Montgomery. She's 10 weeks pregnant. We're busting to tell people. She finally started announcing it on Facebook on Sunday so we can tell everybody. I remember like it was yesterday when they handed me Shelby wrapped up in one of those hospital blankets like a tamale. And I'd never been around a brand new newborn. I'd never been in that kind of situation. And I just remember how tight that thing was and how the tighter you made it, the better she liked it. And I thought, this is an amazing thing. And when I would go to church those first few weeks, I remember older parents and grandparents coming up to us and saying, you know, you better enjoy it. It's not going to last long. And I thought, are you kidding me? We've been up all night for the last three nights. It is going to be an eternity before this girl's out of the house. And here I am. And the next generation has started. And the opportunity that I had has come and gone. We need to take seriously our responsibility to make sure we're doing everything we can to draw our children to the Lord. This is something that I think, and this is the last point, that I can't express to you in words. It's a sense of urgency that either you get it or you don't. But if we do not wake up and realize that losing 50, 60% of 20,000 plus kids a year is unacceptable, then we will never appreciate the grace of God. We will never come to know the love of God. This love for the lost is not some arm's length transactional process that we do in evangelistic studies through our minister or occasionally by ourselves directly. It's something that most of us, by God's blessing, have the opportunity to do as parents each and every day. And we need to realize that we're in a spiritual war. And that battle is won. But only if you realize you can't take it for granted, the outcome for granted. That there will be collateral losses, and they could be your own children. You know, we're hearing a lot in the news right now about how our religious liberties are under attack. I speak from church to church for the last year about the last year's Supreme Court decision that basically are trying to pigeonhole your religious freedom into what you do in this building. They really don't want it to impact public life. They'll let you talk about it, teach and advocate, but they don't really acknowledge the fact you have the right to exercise your religion to the fullest extent of the First Amendment. And that's going to challenge us in many ways. But just in the last 30 days, we've been challenged in ways like never before. Iowa has ruled, their Civil Rights Commission has ruled that the churches there are places of public accommodation, and they must allow congregants and visitors to use their restroom based on their own personal gender identity rather than their biological sex. It also forbids any hostility or unwelcoming speech. So I'm not sure what a preacher could get in trouble for in Iowa for actually preaching what Romans 1 or 1 Corinthians 6 has to say about sex attraction. In the last 30 days, the Supreme Court has issued another decision. Many people aren't even aware of it. In the state of Washington, pharmacists who conscientiously object to providing people with medicine that would induce an abortion abortion-inducing pills, as a matter of faith, have said, look, we're pharmacists, we'll do our job, but if they want those pills, they need to go somewhere else. State of Washington sanctioned them, threatened to take away their license. They appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court even just refused to hear the case this month. Here's what Justice Alito said about that decision, to refuse to even hear the case. It's an ominous sign. This case raised the simple issue where the people get to live their lives and operate their business according to their faith. It is indeed ominous when the government orders people to violate their faith and the nation's highest court doesn't consider the topic worthy of debate. For constitutional scholars and attorneys, alarms are going off everywhere. The opportunity that we have to influence our children, to practice our religion and exercise our religion, is something we shouldn't be taking for granted. Psalms 127 says, children are a heritage from the Lord, fruit of the womb, a reward, like arrows in the hands of a warrior. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver full of them. But remember this, these arrows are for a purpose. These arrows will be taken out of the quiver and pointed in a direction. And it's critical that we understand the urgency of training our children up, as Ephesians 6 commands us to do. But remember this, the enemy is not the liberals, it's not the secular colleges, it's not the world and its cultural influences. Ephesians chapter 6 says, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. You see, we've got to withstand the schemes of no one less than the devil himself. One of the challenges of understanding our responsibility to prepare and lead and urgently seek what is best for our young people is to realize that we're part of an army of God fighting against spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. And our weapons, according to Ephesians 6, are truth and righteousness and peace and faith and salvation, all of which come from understanding and meditating and teaching our children the Word of God, and then praying to God that He will take care of it. Tonight, I don't know how urgent your situation is. As a young person, I don't know if spiritually you're feeling at risk. As parents, I don't know if you're feeling the guilt of falling short in your responsibility. I met an individual when I was in South Korea from North Korea, now living in South Korea. And Brother Young took me to the demilitarized zone. And he pointed northward. And he said, 37 miles away is the village where all of my family's from. And many of my relatives are still there. But there's no communication out of North Korea. I don't know if they're alive or dead. 37 miles away, and there's no radio, there's no cell, there's no internet, there's no TV, there's nothing coming in and out of North Korea. But he's a Christian. And he saw the need to prepare himself to preach the gospel. And he saw the need for him to take the leadership of the commission that God gave us as the director of a small little correspondence course. And he saw the urgency of doing the impossible. And so he chartered a boat and he looked at the airflow maps on the map along the west coast of North Korea. And then he prepared helium balloons filled with plastic copies, plastic the thickness of maybe your Wonder Bread sacks. And printed on that plastic is the entire Gospel of Mark. And then he wadded all those gospel copies of the gospel up into helium balloons, and he released them from this fishing boat off the coast of North Korea. where he, based on the air patterns, they were likely to float over the cities, of the biggest cities of North Korea. And then he placed in each one of those helium balloons a GPS device designed to pop the balloon when it reached those targeted areas. And then, falling to earth, were thousands of copies of, in Korean, of the Book of Mark. Now, folks, that's preparing. That's leadership. That's a true sense of urgency. And if people on the other side of the world are going to that great of length to try to bring the gospel, the good news, to help people from being lost that they don't even know, how much more should we do to try to save those most precious to us? Tonight, if you have a need, we're going to sing an invitation. And if you believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and you're willing to repent of your sins and confess Him as your Lord and Savior and put Him on in the water grave of baptism, we are here for you tonight. We'll be glad to assist you. If you are Christian and you recognize that you need to repent, to confess your sin, 1 John 1 and 2 says that if you'll confess your sin, He is just and able to forgive you of those sins. Not just to wash away the guilt, but to empower you so that you, once again sanctified, can be used for His glory. Whatever your need is, please come as we stand and sing. Yes,